Welcome to HQAF Radio.
I'm Alana.
And this is a show about two best friends. Welcome back, everybody. It's your favorite co-host, me, Alana. I am not here with Francis. Today I'm with a very, very special guest, Patrick, my brother. You guys remember him from, I don't know, like a year ago? 2 years ago? I don't know.
It was a while ago. College tuition or something, I think.
Yeah. And now he's back. And he's back during a very crazy time. We're in quarantine right now. Our state is in lockdown until June. And we have a lot of feelings about it. So I just want to start this journey off, Patrick, with asking, how has quarantine been for you? How's it going?
Honestly, it's either not changed my life that much or just benefited me. Because I don't really go out that much anyway. So being able to just have an excuse for not going anywhere is nice. But really, I just like not having to get up, get dressed, get on the metro, go into D.C.
Yeah.
And spend 2 hours of my life every day commuting when I could just roll out of bed at 8:30 and just call in and work from home. I rarely ever have to get out of bed when I'm working every day. It's pretty nice.
Yeah. And I will say, too, that it hasn't really changed my life either, because I'm not someone who, like, goes out a lot or stays out late or hangs out with a lot of friends. You guys know, if you've been following very closely, I mostly just leave my apartment to see Francis and go to work. And that's kind of it. But it has been a crazy time. I don't know. So how long have you been in quarantine? Like, how long has it been since you've been working from home? Like, everything, you're not going into the office, it's not a regular routine.
I think actually exactly a month today, March 17th.
Yeah, it's been a little over a month for me. I started working from home, like, my last day in the office was March 13th. And, yeah, it's really been strange, for a lot of reasons, right? It's, like, changed everything. But at the same time, I think the greatest thing that has changed is the political climate. And that has been very interesting to follow, very hair-raising, very nerve-wracking, but also somewhat hopeful, if you're, dare I say it, on the right team. I'm sorry, but I'm just not going to be able to hold back my political opinions, audience. But I am not a fan of Donnie T, as I once had a coworker call him. I just think he's terrible, garbage, human person, like, actual piece of shit. And this crisis, I think, has really exemplified that, has really just amplified that. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Patrick, so far? Just give us a little taste and then we're going to, like, really go into it.
Well, I feel for, like, the last 3 years has been the president constantly making things, just making a disaster of everything, but sort of getting away with it because at the end of the day, everybody kind of does their job and just sort of adapts to his shenanigans. And so, at the end of the day, it doesn't really affect him how much he completely botches things.
Yeah.
And yet, finally we have a crisis where he can't just simply keep spinning it because people actually die and people lose their jobs. And then all of a sudden, the whole concept of electing someone who's never held government office before or served in the military or had really any political experience whatsoever was maybe not such a great idea.
Right. Yeah, and the one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like people have been very, maybe, indifferent or apathetic about him, and part of that was because, like, yes, he's a giant, like, people who weren't very passionately, like, felt very impassioned about how much they hated him, like, people were apathetic because, hey, the economy's great.
Well,
that's
yeah, I'll
great.
Give you an example. One of my best friends from one of the video game communities that I would compete in. He's moved around a lot. Right now he lives in Idaho, but he's not from Idaho. He's from Arizona and he lived in Delaware and they lived in a bunch of other places. But right now he's living with Idaho because whatever reasons, because of roommates or something like that. And he has two Twitter accounts. He has his public Twitter account and he has a private one for, like, venting. And in his private one, of course, I'm not going to name him, so that way you guys can't, like, figure out who he is. But
yeah.
In his private one, he said that, you know, he doesn't care. He's just going to vote for Trump anyway because everybody said the world was going to end and then it didn't. And so, because the economy's good and it didn't really affect him that much.
Yeah.
It's like, why should he care? Keep in mind, though, he is a white male. Albeit he's a member of the LGBT community because he is gay, but he is still a white male, though.
Right.
You can't really know that he's gay unless he says that he's gay.
Yeah.
So he's not really in one of the demographics that's been the hardest hit by Trump. But now we have coronavirus, which really doesn't discriminate. Well, that's not really true. It sort of does in the sense that minorities, particularly African-Americans, die at higher rates. But that's more to do with the hospital systems and sort of...
And also institutional, income. Well, like,
yeah, yeah. It's socioeconomic status. Yeah. It's institutionalized. But then the number of factors. So it's not really a disease that's discriminating. It's more the way that society reacts to it.
Yeah.
But that's sort of beyond the point. The point is, though, that he's not really a member of one of the demographics that have been hardest hit by it, namely Latinos and immigrants. And most minority groups either haven't been helped or have been harmed by various economic policies.
So has he changed his opinion? Is that kind of like...
But the thing is, yeah. No, he seems to be indifferent because, like, well, you know, if it's good for me, then why does it matter?
Does he still have a job? It's
a cynical way of... that's a good question. I think he works... I think his job is tech-related.
Oh, okay.
Like, he doesn't do tech, but he worked at a tech company. And so I think it's very much phone and computer-based. So I think he's just teleworking.
Yeah.
So once again, because he's not in the group that got hurt by this, then it doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, perfectly honest, for me, I'm not hurt by this either. If anything, I benefit under Trump, and I'm still not going to vote for him because just because it's good for me in the short term doesn't mean it's good for me or really the country in the long term. So
yeah.
But that's sort of beside the point. But it sort of echoes the sentiment that a lot of people just don't really care that much because as long as they're not in that bucket of people that is really affected, they're like, whatever. Vote for the devil you know than the one that you don't, so they'll just throw their dice with Trump again. But I will have to look at it to see if that actually will be enough to carry him through.
Right, and that is one of the many enigmas and mysteries that we're going to be uncovering a little bit in today's episode, so stay tuned. So what I think is the most interesting... just very serendipitous aspect of this whole coronavirus thing is the fact that it is happening just, you know, 6 months out from an election. A presidential election is happening this November. And, of course, this wasn't planned, obviously. Nothing like this is planned. But it does make for the political landscape to be ever-changing and just, like, very interesting to follow. So my question to you is, Patrick, and I guess to back up before I ask you, I do want to establish that Patrick is very well-versed, very well-read, someone who has been following politics for a very long time, so he has a lot of, like, historical reference, historical background, kind of just having interest. Even when he was a kid, he was someone that, like, followed politics and elections very closely. And so, yeah, I wanted to ask you, Patrick, if you would share with the audience how you think coronavirus is going to affect the election.
Well, people might have forgotten already, but we are still technically in the middle of a primary. The Democratic primary is not technically over yet because no one has reached a majority of delegates, being 1991. But fortunately, this coronavirus didn't really start hitting its worst levels yet, or rather, people weren't sort of forced to quarantine and not do anything in sort of public group gatherings until much later into the primary.
Yeah, like after Super Tuesday, which Super Tuesday was a pretty
big... Yeah, it was sort of on the fringes, on the radar, you know, probably way back even in Iowa. But it was sort of just a thing that was sort of on the side. They're like, oh, well, you know, whatever. It's a couple cases. Whatever. We'll deal with it.
Yeah.
We dealt with H1N1 swine. We dealt with Ebola and all that stuff. So they probably thought it was something like that. So people weren't really paying that much attention to it.
Yeah.
But starting on in the primary, you know, you had... Well, for much of the primary before the actual voting started, you had Biden was pretty much the front runner the entire time. And then Iowa happened, and I think he got fourth or fifth place. It was something abysmal like that.
Yeah, that kind of changed the game.
Keep in mind, Iowa is a caucus state, which is a little bit weird. In which case, people vote twice, where like they have a first choice and then a second choice. So,
oh, is that what a caucus is?
Yeah, it's where people you have. It's kind of a pain in the ass unless you're like really into it, which is kind of why you have fringe candidates tend to do better in it because they have more devoted supporters who are willing to do that stuff. Whereas people who are kind of just voting for the least evil, they kind of just want to show up and vote and not have to commit to anything. Whereas these things are like, you really have to actually show up, and it's like it's a collaborative process.
Yeah.
So people have to go to their caucus site, and they sort of stand in a group of people who are supporting the different candidates, and then if their candidate doesn't meet a certain viability threshold, which means a certain percentage, they're allowed to vote a second time and rearrange themselves with other candidates.
Oh my god, that's crazy.
So it's sort of like ranked choice ballots, but not. There's some other caveats that I'm really sure about, but
yeah.
There were fewer caucus states this cycle than there were 4 years ago because a lot of states have moved towards primaries because primaries have much higher turnout than caucuses, namely because they're more convenient because you sort of show up, you vote, and you go home.
Right, yeah.
There's none of that in-person, you know, voice votes and strategically moving about your assets and things like that.
So Biden wasn't doing too hot after the very first.
Yeah, so Biden seemed like the early favorite. I mean, really, since he announced in May or April of last year, and even before then, he was largely leading the polls before he announced, and everybody knew he was going to announce, he was sort of waiting when.
Yeah.
But then when push came to shove, when people started voting, well, you had Buttigieg win the plurality of delegates, but Sanders got the plurality of the popular vote.
Yeah.
Then in New Hampshire, you had Sanders win a plurality of the popular vote, and I think Biden once again got fourth or fifth place.
Oh my God.
Another abysmal showing. And a lot of people were thinking that Biden's campaign was pretty much dead and that he was going to have to drop out in a couple of weeks.
And even you were kind of feeling the same way, right?
I moved my support like three times, I think. Before Biden announced, I was pretty much in his wing.
Yeah.
Because I kind of just like, you know, establishment doesn't rock the boat too much kinds of candidates. I'm very skeptical of big, you know,
revolutionary.
Yeah, I
changes.
Don't really think. I think if you look at how government actually works, those types of things don't tend to happen. The only way real change happens is usually behind closed doors in, you know, amendments and pork bills and things like that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Biden's better at because he's in the Senate for 30-something years. But so yeah, I was like, okay, well, you know, he's competent. He was VP for 8 years, under a relatively competent administration. So I'll go with him. Then he didn't do so great in the debates during the summer. I'm like, okay, you know, still probably going to vote for him. But then Andrew Yang, you know, his platform sounded most interesting to me. I still didn't think he really had any chance of winning, but I thought maybe, I don't know, if he did well enough, that might give him a polling bounce or something, or maybe bring him enough into the spotlight that maybe somebody would want to pick him for VP or put his, you know, platform ideas in. But I think he was just too young and, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years early.
Yeah.
And so then Bloomberg joined in, and platform-wise, I agreed with a lot of what he said. You know, he's one of the few sort of not advocating for massive government, like, takeovers of, like, industry and taxes and things like that. You know, he was proposing raising taxes on himself and, you know, other millionaires and billionaires. But, nice. You know, he wasn't advocating for things like the wealth tax, which is sort of a tax on just having money. Like, not making money, but just having it, sitting in a bank, basically. You get taxed every year for having it.
Yeah.
You know, and he's very good on the environment. He's very good on gun control. Really, the main problems he had was he's not a great candidate. he has a really just a crappy personality. He's not good at, you know, talking to people. And, of course, he had, you know, stop and frisk. And so, if you can't do well with African-Americans, you're not going to win the primary, and you're definitely not going to win the election.
Right.
Because African-Americans make up, you know, they vote about 85 to 90% Democratic. So right. If you can't get that massive majority every single time, you can call it quits.
And they turn out, it sounds like you are saying as well.
Well, actually, in general elections, they tend to have lower turnout than white voters, which is, you know, could be attributed to a number of things. Which we probably won't get into, but there's a lot of
voter
suppression type things.
I know. Oh my god. And we just don't have the podcast for it.
They tend to work, you know, gig jobs where they can't get time off to then go and vote so there's a lot of factors going to go into it, but they have turned out in high numbers in certain, you know, momentous elections like Obama in 2008.
Yeah. So what was really interesting and what you will take us through, I imagine, is that he was kind of just like old soup, old news, or it seemed like he wasn't really going anywhere. Biden? And then what happened? Yeah, so tell us about
what So I was going to vote for Bloomberg, and then the two debates happened, and he just did absolutely terrible. He was given the most basic attacks that he really should have had answers prepared for, and he just sort of retreated into a shell and just sort of, mumbled his answers, and it was terrible. So I'm like, okay, this guy's no show. I mean, I knew it was probably going to be a long show for him anyway, because there's no way the Democrats are going to pick a billionaire.
I know. Because
they're all like, let's eat the rich kind of stuff. So I'm like, oh, that's not going to happen.
I know.
But I was desperately just trying to say, like, who's the non-Bernie alternative?
Yeah.
Because I was getting PTSD and it was looking like 2016, but instead of the Republicans, it was the Democrats this time.
Yeah.
But then, you know, South Carolina happened and the African-American vote, they turned out in big droves with the help of Jim Clyburn.
Who's that?
He's a veteran congressman in South Carolina and civil rights activist. I forget how long he's been in Congress, but a very long time. His endorsement means a lot in that state.
Oh, wow. And he endorsed Biden?
Biden the week of, and Biden ended up winning, I think, 48% of the vote in South Carolina.
Oh, my God.
When CNN was doing the results, they called the election the second the polls closed. So the exit polls had him up that much that they could project immediately.
Oh my God.
All of a sudden, there was life breathed into his campaign. And keep in mind, this was the Saturday before Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay, well then right after that, on the Sunday before Super Tuesday, you have Buttigieg drop out and Klobuchar drop out, and they both endorse Biden. And you have him do a last-minute rally in Texas with Beto O'Rourke, congressman who famously challenged Ted Cruz in the 2018 Senate race and almost upset him. He only lost by two or three points, I think. I think it was the closest the Democrats ever come to winning Texas in some 30 years, like a very long time.
Whoa.
So he gave him his endorsement. And then,
I could smell
which way the wind was blowing. So strategically, I was like, I'm going to vote for Biden because I want to wrap this thing up, because I could tell where the momentum was going.
Yeah.
So I voted in Virginia, voted for Biden. And of the first two states to close, Vermont and Virginia, they called Virginia immediately for Biden.
Yeah.
And he ended up winning Virginia by a larger margin than Bernie Sanders won his home state of Vermont.
Wow. That's crazy.
And on Super Tuesday, Biden ended up sweeping the entire South, along with Texas.
Wow.
Which was very competitive, and Sanders had a lead on for weeks.
Yeah.
And then he won in Minnesota, which was another state that Bernie Sanders was leading in, or at least he was competitive with Klobuchar, but Klobuchar's endorsement was enough to carry Biden over the top. He won in Maine, where Sanders was winning in the polls by a large margin, and Biden had no presence in whatsoever. He won in Massachusetts, beating both Warren and Sanders, where he spent no money and had no presence.
Yeah.
And then he even came to a second place, albeit it was a distant second place, in California. I think 7 or 8 points behind Sanders. But Sanders, you know, a week before is up 20 or 30 points. So he managed to close the gap there. And because the primaries are proportional, just because you don't get first doesn't mean you get nothing. You still get your share of the delegates.
Yeah.
And so then all of a sudden, from having to chase Bernie Sanders, Biden became the front runner again. If you looked at the polls in January and you took a time machine and went into March, you would have noticed no difference, because it went from Biden being the front runner to the front runner again. If you just ignore all of February when Sanders was the front runner, then it would be like nothing happened.
Yeah, because that's when the primary started, or the Iowa caucus was in February,
right.
And that's when it started all the...
Yeah, so Biden looked like he was the front runner, and, you know, 538 had him projected to win, I think, most, if not all, of the primaries. Then, for a brief while, it looked like Sanders might be the one who wins, or more likely case, it would be a contested convention where nobody gets a majority, because it would be a divided field. But then Biden kind of, he unified the moderate wing of the party, and sort of everybody kind of rallied to his side. And Sanders just really wasn't ready to respond to that. Just the shellacking he got in South Carolina, coupled with all those endorsements over the weekend and the free media that Biden got. It just was nothing he could really do about that. Sanders really didn't really have he didn't really have like a super big comprehensive coalition. He kind of just had the same people 4 years ago, but
and even less of them,
even
right?
Fewer, largely because it suspected a significant portion of his support. Well, not significant, but like a large minority of his support was just sort of an anti-Hillary vote.
Oh.
Because they were made up of white working class men who then voted for Biden. So one might wonder if there's just either a sexist or just an anti-Clinton bias that caused Sanders to be more competitive than the polls would suggest 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But this time, you know, once it was down to a two-man race, he really didn't stand a chance. I think once Super Tuesday was over, really the primary was over. Tuesday 2... you know, Bernie Sanders was trying to eke out that win in Michigan because 4 years ago he had a 20-point polling deficit against Clinton, and then he managed to pull out a huge upset, winning narrowly by, I think, less than a half a percentage point.
Wow.
By winning these rural white working class counties, and then 4 years later, Biden wins by like 20 points, and he wins every single county in the state.
Yeah.
Missouri, another state, was neck and neck. I think Clinton barely won 4 years ago. Biden wins it by like 30 points, and he wins every single county.
Yeah. So it wasn't...
In Washington State, albeit this was a caucus state 4 years ago, which means that it favors the candidates that have more enthusiastic supporters. So 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders won the Washington State caucuses by 72% to 27%. And then this time around, Biden beat him by 2 points, like narrowly.
Yeah.
38 to 36, I think, something like that. And once again, keep in mind, Bernie Sanders dropped, I think, about $2 million in Washington State. Biden spent less than $10,000.
Yeah.
I could have just given the money out of my bank account to pay for the debts. That's how little money we're talking about.
Yeah. So coronavirus didn't necessarily, because I'm sure, I feel like there are Bernie supporters who are like, oh my God, Bernie would have won had, because coronavirus did start.
Well, yeah,
start
now that's
canceling.
An interesting thing, because coronavirus was starting right after Super Tuesday 2.
Yeah.
That's when coronavirus was seriously, people were like, okay, we actually have to, we have to close things down. We need to socially distance. We can't have this anymore. You know, even in the Super Tuesday 2 in Washington State, where they have mail-in only ballots, you had people dropping off their things, these boxes outside the polling places because they don't want to go in.
Yeah.
And you have all the workers wearing their masks and their gloves as they're counting the paper ballots and stuff like that. So they were getting ready on Super Tuesday 2. And Super Tuesday 3, which was the four states, although Ohio postponed theirs until June at the last minute, defying a state court order, which, you know, I guess the governor sort of ruled that. I said, well, whatever, what are they going to do about it? It's the day before. I'm the governor. I can stop it.
Yeah, whatever. Right. Okay, yeah.
Which, you know, people have different opinions on it, whether or not it was right to cancel it. But on Super Tuesday 2, you know, Biden won Florida by 40 points. He won Illinois by 25 points. He won Arizona by like 15 points. Ohio wasn't going to happen, but it was probably going to be another 20-point win. But what you did see is you did see significantly lower turnout in these states. There was a large amount of mail-in votes, like early voting, but there was a much lower turnout.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think the Bernie camp will try to point to and say, well, we need these rallies to get Turner people out. And, you know, obviously we need people not to be afraid to even vote. So that helps too. But there's sort of some problems with that, because if you look back at Michigan, which was the week before, where people were still sort of showing up as rallies in full force, it didn't really translate into actual winning votes.
Yeah.
And really the problem was, is he didn't do anything to expand his coalition from 4 years ago. He did pick up a large share of the Latino vote, yes, but he didn't build anywhere else. He was still sort of largely appealing to young voters and not really any other demographic.
Yeah.
because, you know, he has his set of ideals, and because he's uncompromising in that, well, he's not really going to get the more moderate voters to vote for him. Yeah. He didn't really make any attempt to try to water it down or spin it, which I know, I guess, his more hardcore fans probably wouldn't like, but that's kind of what you have to do to win an election. if you look at any general election, you know, the Republican nominee in the primaries will always be more conservative, at least the way he talks, than the way he talks in the general. Same thing, the Democrat will talk more progressive than in the primaries than he will talk in the general election, because you have to swing to a different demographic. And I know that seems like it's, you know, it's kind of two-faced, but that's politics.
Yeah.
You know, it's coalition building, you know.
Yeah.
You have to kind of appeal to both your base and then the swing independent voters. So you can't really just be a diehard ideologue and hope to win elections unless you just happen to be in an area where the majority of people think that.
Right.
So I don't buy the rallies really doing him in. I think it's more just poor reach out to other groups of people to vote for him. And, you know, I guess another thing that was clear, though, is that when exit polls were conducted, people said in very large majorities that they would prefer Biden to handle a crisis like coronavirus than Bernie Sanders. And that's probably because they see him as sort of been there, done that, because he was the VP under Obama.
Yeah.
And they're kind of just looking for that reliable competence rather than sort of the untested, you know, remaking of the system.
Right.
And, you know, another thing is, you know, it's debatable whether or not this was really the year he could ever win anyway, because given that Trump is president, you know, I think Bernie stood a real chance in 2016 because it was an open seat. He wasn't running against an incumbent president.
Yeah.
Against an incumbent president, especially one as divisive as Trump is, not, you know, not just in policy, just literally look at the polls, right? He's had the most consistent... He's had the smallest standard deviation. That means the spread of his approval and disapproval ratings of any president in history. It's been consistently negative, but not by much, by only like a couple of points. And it's just sort of stayed like that. It's moved up and down every now and then, but it's always kind of converged around like, you know, plus 43 approve and then, you know, minus 50, 51 disapprove.
Oh my God.
He's been underwater, I think, every single day.
Like his entire presidency,
except for the first day. I think he was barely above water the first day. Because usually people give the elected president the benefit of the doubt, and then they're like, oh, wait, this is real. And then
right, yeah, and then naturally...
They assess, yeah. So you'll usually see either a re-elected president or a new president have very high, you know, approval ratings starting their administration, and then they'll sort of quickly drop once people realize, oh, wait, they're not going to magically fix everything like they said they would in 90 days.
Right.
So... he's basically been underwater his entire presidency, and it's gone, you know, it's gotten worse, it's gotten better. It was going up when he changed his tune on coronavirus, but it kind of just went right back to where it was, which is sort of minus 51 plus, you know, 44.
Right, and that's something I want to talk to you about in the next segment. Now, the next big question that is on everyone's mind, especially mine, is, do you think that this means, we can defeat Trump? Like, he doesn't stand a chance.
I would not jump to conclusions.
Oh, really?
I think 2016 proved that anything is possible.
Yikes.
Because the number of things that had to go right for him at the right time for him to become president in 2016 really shows that you can't predict anything, especially not this far out. There's nothing but October surprises in 2016.
Yeah.
And sort of coupled with, you know, just happening to have the right amount of turnout and the right amount of lower turnout on the Democratic side in these key states in the Midwest for him to pull off the win. Because if you look at the popular vote, he lost by 2.8 million votes. It's the largest a president has ever managed to win the Electoral College while losing the popular vote.
Damn. Well...
So I would not write him off, even if this is going to cause, you know, the worst economic disaster since the recession or even the Great Depression. You know, we're still not really sure what's going to happen when things reopen, if it will immediately bounce back and create a so-called zombie economy, or if it really will just have large residual losses due to the businesses that simply run out of cash to keep themselves afloat during the shutdown. We'll have to see on that, but... The point is, you know, I think it's very dangerous to write him off so early. I mean, I think until we see the votes come out of the Rust Belt and other swing states, I'm not going to write them off.
Yeah.
But the thing is, though, is if you asked me the same question before coronavirus, I would have said Trump was probably a slight favorite to win re-election. Maybe like 55-45.
Really?
Yeah. And that goes sort of, you can completely ignore all of his policies and just sort of look at historical trends. The last time an incumbent president was, I don't want to say unseated, because that's sort of a term used for congressmen and senators, defeated, was H.W. Bush in 92.
Whoa, wow. And
every other election, and before that, the last time was Jimmy Carter in 1980.
Oh.
And before that was Herbert Hoover in 1932.
Oh my God.
So.
This doesn't happen often, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and before that, I think was Taft. I forget what year was. That was the one where Teddy Roosevelt came back from the woodworks and ran in the Bull Moose Party as a third party candidate.
Really?
Yeah, because he was the Republican, and I think Taft was his VP.
Yeah.
And then Roosevelt's like, okay, I'm done with politics. Bye. You take care of the Republicans for me. He comes back from a big game hunt in Africa, and then he's like, oh, God, you ruined the country. I need to fix this. So he ran and ran. It was a three-way race between him, Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. Then Woodrow Wilson ended up winning.
Really?
Yeah, and he got two terms.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, the point is you can count on, like, one hand. So I think it was four times in the 20th century
that
20th and 21st century, the last 120-something years, that a sitting president has lost their re-election. It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Because even if you ignore the polls, people tend to want to vote for the devil they know than the one they don't. So even if it's bad, as long as they're not getting screwed over that much, they're like, yeah, whatever, you know, how bad could it be? Whereas this untested guy, I don't know if it's going to be another roller coaster like Trump was term one. Maybe Trump term two, it'll be fine, it'll mellow out, whatever. Mm. And you combine that with the fact that before coronavirus, he had an amazing economy. Probably the lowest unemployment rate, I think, since 1960?
Wow.
No, 1960-something. Like, basically, like, the lowest unemployment rate since, like, an economic boom in the 60s. I forget what statistic it was.
Yeah.
We were below 4% unemployment, I think. We were, like, 3.7% unemployment.
That's crazy.
And there's this old saying in politics called, it's the economy, stupid? Where, basically, voters tend to care more about the economy than anything else. Because at the end of the day, as long as they have enough money to feed their families, all other issues kind of sit on the sidelines. Because they don't really care about climate change if they can't afford to pay their rent.
Yeah.
They don't really care about gun regulations if they can't afford to buy food, right?
Right.
So well, everything kind of comes second to the economy.
Yeah. Doesn't that mean then that the one thing that made Trump a viable candidate is out the window? I mean, the economy.
Well, yeah, see, that's the thing.
22 million people have filed for unemployment in the last 4 weeks. Like,
yeah, and keep in mind, before that, the largest recorded ever number of unemployment filings in a month, I think, was 600,000. So yeah. We're talking about something like a 35-fold increase or something like that.
Doesn't that matter to people?
It does, but I think the thing is that not enough people have run out of money yet.
Right.
Where to really see his approval rating start dipping really, really low. His approval rating, he is underwater again. He was briefly going up when he changed his tune in coronavirus, saying, like, okay, well, you know, actually it is serious when you're going to do blah, blah, blah. Right. So he was acting quote unquote presidential, but then people kind of came to grips with the reality and kind of went back to his usual shirking responsibilities, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And now his approval rating, I think, according to RealClear Politics, he's on an average of -5. So he's approve 45, disapprove 50.
Oh, my gosh. I still can't believe...
But see, the thing is, he's still positive on the economy. Albeit the last poll was done on the 14th. So maybe the new data coming. He's still approve 52 on the economy, disapprove 42.
Like, yeah, what's shocking to me is that it's not lower. Because here's a guy who's talking about how great his ratings are. And how, you know, just... paraded around initially.
Right, but he does a thing where, like, he'll cherry pick polls and say, this one has me up and every other poll. So even if, like, 90 out of 100 polls have him negative, he'll look at the 10 that have him positive and say, okay, that means I'm up.
Yeah.
A lot of times they're either from dubious sources or they're just outliers.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't really think the laws of statistics are something that he's super well versed in or would be willing to acknowledge in any real capacity.
Yeah. Well, I guess, and so do you think that the only reason why he's not lower is because Trump is creating his own reality right now? I mean, his whole idea is like fake news, lamestream media, don't believe anyone, just believe me. He's tweeting all the time. Like, is he just creating a reality for himself and his supporters, and that's why he's not tanking?
I think he's just sort of doing the strategy that got him elected in the first place, which is where if you just simply get yourself in the news often enough, it really doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Just being in the news is getting your name out there. And
oh my God.
If you just keep repeating a lie enough times, people will just sort of start believing it or not really questioning it. And so that's kind of what it is. He just sort of ignores reality and just says his own thing because his base of support will kind of just eat it up. He has trained them to believe that any form of independent media is out to conspire against him and is not at all giving them truth. He says that he's the only source of truth. That's why he created One America Network. And that's why he took the One America Network woman, I think, and then brought him on to this, what is it called? The, his press secretary, who's never given a press briefing, because he stopped doing that, because he doesn't like the unfair coverage he gets, you know?
Whoa. That's crazy.
You know, it's almost like a Ministry of Truth out of 1984, having his own government, you know?
Yeah. So everyone's just drinking the Kool-Aid, like...
Yeah, well, his 37-38% supporters, and then I guess some other single-digit percentage of independents that sort of lean towards him.
And I guess it's the fact that he also...
And remember, the thing is, he doesn't have to win a majority of the popular vote to win. I don't know who's going to win the election. I know who's going to win the popular vote, and it's not going to be Trump.
Right.
I think there's a good chance Trump... I think it's, you know... I think now it's probably, you know, he's probably the Biden, you know, the presumptive nominee by virtue of everyone else dropping out. I think he is now the slight favorite to win. So I'd say he's 55-45 like Trump was maybe a year ago. Well, not a year ago, but like Trump was, you know, a couple months ago.
Yeah.
So I'd say Biden's the slight favorite right now. But, you know, like I said, there's so many variables that have yet to be accounted for.
Yeah.
But I'd say... Given how this coronavirus disaster pans out, both economically and health-wise, it's just, there's no real way it could be good for Trump unless somehow everything gets better and then he gets credit for it. I don't really see how that happens.
Yeah.
Because odds are there's going to be a second wave in the fall, which, of course, you know, makes people wonder how that's going to affect the election in November.
Right. And, like, do you think that he is so adamant about... like, opening states up and like, stopping lockdowns because the economy was sort of the only thing, right?
You have his Republican surrogate saying that, you know, don't make the solution worse than the problem. Don't have the virus of, you know, of quarantine be worse than the virus of, you know, coronavirus.
Yeah.
And there's people, you know, they're like Bill O'Reilly said, well, you know, it doesn't matter. The people that are dying on their last legs anyway. Well, that's not really true. There's plenty of young people that are dying and people with health problems that are dying.
Yeah.
Or they're saying like, well, you know, it's a small price to pay for not having the economy be completely, well, you know, they're like, oh, well, it's only a 2% kill rate. Well, if you infects, you know, 60% of the country, you're talking about a couple million people dying. It's not going to be enough body bags to deal with all the corpses at the same time.
Yeah.
It's already almost killed more people than the seasonal flu this year.
Really?
Yeah, in the United States. And given that of confirmed cases, the latest tracker from Johns Hopkins University...
what do they have it at?
I don't know the percentages here for some reason.
Oh, I feel like they're usually that.
Yeah, usually this thing has it. They're really good about it, and they're not showing it for some reason.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Yeah, it's just...
Well, last time I looked earlier today, it was 5% in the U.S.
Whoa.
We're at 37,000 deaths and 708,000 confirmed cases.
Yeah.
Which, if I do the math...
And he will, because he is a mathematician.
37,000 divided by 700,000 is about 5%. Yeah. But keep in mind, the seasonal flu is a fatality rate of about 0.1%.
Oh my God.
So, coronavirus is 50 times deadlier.
Yeah.
In the United States. In Europe, it's even worse.
Yeah.
In Belgium, I think they're up to a 14% fatality rate. Italy's about 13%. Spain's about 13%.
Whoa. Well, is that because they're smaller countries? Because we have more cases than they do. Or is it just because all the people died?
When I say fatality rate, I'm saying how many of the people that are infected, what percentage dies?
Oh, yeah.
So that doesn't care about size.
Yeah.
That's proportional. We're at 5%, and I think the reason why we have a lower fatality rate is because we're not small, highly urbanized, public transportation using, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Setup like they are. And we also don't have as much of a large, like, older population because, well, our people have lower life expectancies. Because we don't have the Mediterranean diets and all that stuff.
Right, yeah.
And I guess you probably argue worse healthcare or something like that. But
yeah.
The point is, given those factors, we end up having a lower fatality rate. But we still have the most deaths total, but like I said. But if you look at China, though, they peaked out weeks ago, and they only have 4,600 deaths, and they have over, you know, I think 1.5 billion people or something like that. Let me see, China population. Well,
and then also, aren't they, like, seeing coronavirus come back? It's resurged. Yeah,
they have 1.4 billion people.
Yeah.
We have 327, so they're about four times the size of us, and yet... although, you know, I guess some people might put on their tinfoil hat and say they're lying about how many people have died because the Chinese government hasn't been good about releasing information. So it is possible they're fudging the numbers a little bit to make themselves look good.
Right.
But, but still 5% though.
That's a lot.
That's pretty deadly.
Yes.
That's a lot of people. So yes. If you look at it from the perspective of you yourself, okay, I have a 95% chance of living, yes. But you need to look at it at infecting, you know, 200 million people, right? You know, I'm not going to say everyone's going to get infected, but I'm saying a majority could get infected if there's no restrictions.
But you are saying that with Trump trying to reopen the economy, he is literally putting the economy above people's lives.
Yeah. No, I know he is, because he wants the numbers to look good. But the thing is, it's kind of self-defeating because... What would happen if that happened was you would have a lot more deaths, and I think you'd still get the same, you know, negative publicity. I guess if you want to get really cynical about it, some people might say it still wouldn't be as bad because people still have money in their pockets that don't die, but, you know, that really is just sort of a terrible way of looking at it.
I mean, yeah, they're all just, like, waiting for it to happen if they're all, you know, because we can't return to normal. Not safely right
and
now.
And given the fact that the majority of governors that are implementing these restrictions have very high approval ratings compared to Trump, in somewhere in the 70s and 80s for some cases.
Yeah.
I think most people are happy to comply with these rules, even if it means that they are suffering economic-wise. Now, obviously, you do hear about the protests in Michigan that have started recently.
Yeah,
Where people are sort of blocking up the streets. But I still, once again, I think that's sort of a largely... energized Trump support base that's doing it. And it's not really reflective of either the polling that's been done or really the vast majority of behavior of people in Michigan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great, you know, publicity, but I don't really think it proves anything.
Right. And also, oh my gosh, I saw recently a friend of mine on Facebook posted that she had to delete a bunch of her friends who were saying coronavirus was a conspiracy theory, that it's not real, that it's completely made up, which I was like, I can't believe there are people who think that. Also, why don't you go hang out in a lobby of a hospital and just see how that goes, you stupid fuck. But yeah, it just actually blows my mind how stupid people are in this country. I'm sorry. What is wrong with you?
I don't know. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance, but that's been a thing.
Yeah.
I feel like you're going to have that to support Trump. You know, I give people credit if they voted for him the first time because they're just, like, rolling the dice because, you know, they're kind of sick of hearing the same double talk from politicians. They're like, oh, well, let's try with this guy. But if they still support him now, it's just, it's harder to be sympathetic.
Like, you're just actually an idiot.
You're just actually, like, not educated or...
choosing to be stupid.
You're just choosing, like, to ignore reality.
Yeah.
You're looking... You're the worst case of confirmation bias any social scientist could have possibly studied.
Right, exactly. And I just think that they can't accept being wrong. Like, they're more passionate about, like, I don't want to look like an idiot or I don't want to be wrong, even though he is a terrible, like, he is the wrong person to be handling this. He is not, he was the wrong choice, ultimately. But, yeah, there's just this weird, like, I feel like Trump supporters are just so passionate about, like, I just have to see it through. I don't want to be wrong. I need to wholeheartedly, like, believe in this dissolution. I don't know. It's, someone should do a science, like, not a science, a study on it, you know? Do a research project. Because I cannot figure this shit out. All right. We've been dancing around this for a while now, but let's just talk brass tacks. How do you think this election is going to go? For real. Like, what's the breakdown? What are the numbers? Who are the states? What do we got? What do we got to do?
I'm going to go under the assumption that coronavirus doesn't, you know, cause the November elections to somehow be postponed or suspended or something. Which would have its own set of implications.
Whoa, yeah. Don't want to think like that. I'm already spiraling.
Which, you know, if anyone's nervous, though, A, I don't think Trump has the authority to cancel constitutionally mandated elections. And B, if there were no elections by, I think, January 21st is when the inauguration is?
Yeah, typically.
If there was no election, he'd be kicked out of office anyway because his term expires regardless.
Oh, great.
The Speaker of the House would become president, which would not necessarily be Pelosi because... the House would pick their speaker in January.
Got it.
It's probably going to be here. I don't see Democrats losing the Senate or losing the House.
Yeah.
And I don't see them uprising and picking somebody else. So it probably, in effect, would be Nancy Pelosi. But like I said, that's a weird scenario.
Right.
So let's assume that the elections are held as usual and that they don't magically cause, well, not magically, like they don't cause like, huge amounts of lower turnout like they did in the primaries.
Okay.
And I think there's good indication to think that, you know, we might have a better handle on this going in November and there might be lower susceptibility, but we'll have to see. So let's pretend it's like a normal election and just look at the actual partisan split of the states.
Okay. Let's go.
So right now there's about 6 swing states that are pure toss-ups. You know, Ohio was interesting because that was a swing state. It was a bellwether since, I think, 1964. It's voted for the winner in every single election since then.
Really?
Yeah. But 4 years ago, it voted for Trump by a 7 or 8 point margin.
Really?
It was off by like 10 points from the national popular
Wait,
vote.
Wait, off meaning they hadn't.
Vote as in, Trump. The popular vote nationally, I think, was 48 Clinton, 46 Trump, something like that.
Okay.
In Ohio, well, let me pull up the actual numbers and take a look here.
Yeah, please do.
So if I pull up the result of the presidential election, popular vote-wise, nationally, Clinton had a plurality of 48.2, Trump had 46.1. In Ohio, though... Trump won the state with a solid majority of 51.69%. Hillary Clinton only got 43.56, so that's already an 8-point margin right there.
Yeah.
Ohio, typically, its popular vote tends to line up with the national popular vote. But it was an unprecedented 10.2% more Republican than the national average. So most pundits are not considering Ohio to really be a swing state this cycle, despite the fact that it has been for decades. Mainly yeah. because Trump has such a high appeal there, and he won the state with such a solid margin. There was one poll that came out like a month ago that had Biden up 4 points, but like I said, that's one poll, that's not good data. So until I start seeing trends, I'm firmly keeping that in the camp of Trump. Another state that's historically been a swing state is Iowa, and that's a state that Trump won by almost 10 points when Obama, 4 years earlier, he won the state by 5 points. Wow. So it was a 15-point swing in 4 years.
Oh, my God.
So that's another state. I'm, you know, traditionally it's a swing state. I'm not considering the swing state. I'm giving it to Trump.
Okay.
So really, I think the six swing states we're looking at are the Rust Belt states, you know, the so-called blue wall that turned out to be a not-so-blue wall 4 years ago when Trump flipped them for the first time in 30 years.
Oh, my God.
That being Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Wow. Then we have North Carolina. North Carolina has been reliably Republican for decades, although Obama did very narrowly win the state in 2008.
Yeah.
Then we have Florida, which is the second most reliable bellwether state in the country after Ohio. I think the last time it missed voting for the winning candidate was in 1992, when it voted for Bush Sr. over Clinton. And then new to the map is Arizona, which has been reliably Republican for, I think, since 64, I think.
Wait, so why is it now a swing state?
It's been very competitive in the last couple of cycles until now, where finally Hillary Clinton, I think, only lost the state by 3%.
Really?
It was one of the last states to be called. I think they called Wisconsin before they called Arizona.
Yeah.
And once Wisconsin was called, that was pretty much when people knew that Hillary wasn't going to win.
Yeah.
But, so Arizona, that's a new piece of the map. But what Biden, I think, has going for him is obviously there's changing demographics there. It's becoming more Latino. And I think really Arizona might go the way of Virginia. Virginia being a state that went Republican from 1968 until 2004. Mm-hmm. And then Obama carried it in 2008 and then has gone Democrat the last three elections. So Virginia went from being a red state to being a purple state to being really a blue state.
Yeah.
In the matter of two decades.
Whoa.
And I think Arizona's sort of undergoing that same transition where its population is becoming less white. Another thing, of course, that Biden has going for him is he's doing very well among senior voters, which is a demographic that's historically voted Republican. And yet, in some polls, national polls-wise, you have Biden winning seniors by double digits. If Biden managed to win the senior vote, he'd be the first Democrat to win the senior vote in two decades. Last Democrat to win the senior vote was Al Gore in 2000, and I think he won by like maybe 2 or 3%. Ooh. But other than that, it's been a reliable Republican demographic.
Yeah.
And so if he could bring seniors in, then all of a sudden here's this new voting block. And Arizona being a state famous for being a retirement destination, well, now you have this big block of voters that want to vote for Biden along with the larger Hispanic vote. And then now all of a sudden the state is going from red to blue. And if those trends continue, well, then Arizona might not be a red state anymore. It eventually might not even be a swing state. It might just become a blue state. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the other southwestern state, New Mexico, that was a very competitive swing state. I think Bush carried it in either 2000 or 2004. I gotta look. He carried it in 2004, narrowly, by less than a 1%. And that was a swing state, but now it's been Democrat in every election since then because it has a larger larger Hispanic voting bloc.
Yeah.
And now largely considered to be a safe Democratic state, if not, you know, a likely Democratic state. And so I think if you look at that, and some people are even speculating that Texas might be on the map soon, I think Texas is probably another 10 or 20 years away from that. But, you know, once again, it's those counties in the southern parts of the state that are becoming more Hispanic that is sort of making the state more competitive as a whole. So I think as we look, you know, 20, 30 years from now, I think the Southwest might end up becoming a reliable Democratic voter stronghold. But that's sort of beside the point. So Arizona, I think, though, that's the first sort of real piece to start falling there.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, Biden, I think on average, according to Real Clear Politics, he's up there over 4 points. The most recent poll had him up 9 points with, I think, a 15% advantage on seniors.
Wow.
Interestingly, Biden seems to be winning every single age demographic except for Gen Xers, the 50 to 64-year-olds.
Oh, why?
I'm not really sure. I think it's something that would be interesting to go into. Albeit he's not losing them by much. He's losing them by single digits. But he's winning the young vote because young voters tend to vote Democratic. Albeit he is doing worse with younger voters than past candidates. But the fact that I think he's doing so with seniors is sort of largely overshadowing that. Because when you look at the total advantage he's up 5, 6, 7, you know, maybe 4 points over Trump nationally, and depending which state, roughly the same margin there as well. So it may not matter if there is that, you know, that threatened lower turnout due to Bernie not winning again, just by virtue of the fact that now there's all these senior voters that are voting for Democrats that haven't before.
And if he's doing so well with the older demographic, that must make Florida pretty competitive.
Yeah,
too.
That's another one. It's, you know, right now it's basically neck and neck. Some polls have Trump up, some polls have Biden up. They're not more than like a point or two. Florida, it is a must-win state for Trump.
Why?
Because if Trump manages... So right now, if we look at the states based on what's safe or not, there's 14 combinations that get the Democrat to 270. There's 12 to get the Republican to 270. If we take Florida, which is 29 electoral votes... It's tied for the third most in the country, right? First is California with 55, then it's Texas 38, and then New York and Florida both have 29. If we give that to Biden, then Biden has 5 ways to win the election, and Trump only has 1.
Oh my God!
And that one would be he would have to win every single other swing state.
Yeah.
Which odds are he's not gonna do. Odds are he's gonna lose 1 or 2, and Biden only really has to win 3 of them to win the election. If he wins Florida, he only has to win 2.
Really?
Yeah. If he won Florida, he would only have to pick up 1 other state and he'd be president.
Oh, that's because all of these other states are just... The delegates are so small, right? Comparatively.
Well, they're smaller. Pennsylvania has 20. Michigan has 16. North Carolina has 15. Wisconsin 10. Arizona 11. But Florida's 29, though.
Wait, why is Pennsylvania a toss-up? Isn't he from Pennsylvania?
It is, but remember, Pennsylvania voted for Trump 4 years ago, and,
oh, yeah.
You know, Pennsylvania has been competitive, at least in statewide races. It wasn't so competitive in 2012. I think Obama carried it by, like, 5 or 6 points, which is not super close.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think a lot of analysts were expecting it to become competitive, and so I think, based on the fact that we're this early out, and that it was so competitive 4 years ago that people are putting it in the toss-up category. Biden is up a couple of points there right now on average, but like I said, that's still a toss-up. He's well within the margin of error.
So him being there doesn't matter?
I mean, it'll help, but it's not going to guarantee it to him.
Yeah, okay.
If I were him, I would campaign very heavily in there.
Yeah.
And
why is Wisconsin a toss-up, too? Is that also from 4 years ago?
Yeah. That was a state that voted... It hadn't voted Republican since 1984 until it voted for Trump.
That's crazy. Oh, my gosh.
It was the first chink in sort of the armor of the blue wall that came crumbling down when Trump won that 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Michigan, I think, is probably the likeliest pickup of the swing states. I think Biden's up like 4 or 5 points there. And I think given how unpopular Trump has been there with the African-Americans in sort of the Detroit areas, as well as based on the results from 2018 with Governor Whitmer's election and the midterms there,
And I think, you know, and I think another thing to Biden's credits is he, you know, he did work the auto bailouts in 2009, which obviously the auto industry being in Detroit is a big thing. So yeah. I think Biden will have much more of that appeal to that working class white voter in the Midwest that Hillary Clinton just did not have at all.
Yeah.
And so I think of the Rust Belt states, I think the one I'm most certain of is probably Michigan. But like I said, it's still a toss-up, but I would put it in leaning Democratic.
Yeah.
And so if you give that to Biden, now he's sitting at 248. He only really has to win two more states or just Florida, and then he wins.
Yeah.
But Florida, you know, it has been trending red lately. Trump did carry it, I think, by a solid point 4 years ago. And then in the 2018 midterms, which was a blue wave, if you look at the House results in the statewide elections, in Florida, they elected a Republican governor and a Republican senator. Albeit they were neck-and-neck races, they still won both of them.
Yeah.
So I think some people are even putting that in the leans Republican category, but I'd say it's a pure toss-up. But if you really wanted to, you know, kill off Trump quickly, you would want to win Florida because that would very much limit his options.
Right. And why is North Carolina a toss-up?
North Carolina, it has a very large African-American community, particularly around the Charlotte areas and some of the other urban centers. And result-wise, it's always been close for the last three or four cycles within, you know, 2 or 3 points. But it has, you know, typically gone Republican. But, you know, the Democrats have managed to win statewide elections, I think, with the governorships on occasion. I don't think they had a Democratic senator a while ago, Kay Hagan, I think.
Yeah, and how can Biden do so well in South Carolina, but it's projected that Trump will win?
Well, because just because you win it in the primary doesn't mean it's going to translate to the general. The primary, looking at Democrats voting for Democrats, and the general you're looking at Republicans and Democrats voting for Republicans and Democrats. There's simply just too much of a large conservative white majority in South Carolina to really
make an impact
on the African-American population there.
Yeah. So how do you think this is all gonna like slice and dice?
So I'd say the most likely cases you have Michigan go to Biden, Pennsylvania go to Biden, and then he either wins one or two of Wisconsin and Arizona.
Yeah. But not Florida? You don't think he's got a...
He could win Florida, but I'm talking about probability-wise. I'm saying it's more likely that he wins Wisconsin or Arizona than Florida.
Okay.
If he wins Florida, it's probably game over. Because Trump would have to run the board in all the other five swing states. But if Biden wins Florida, that probably is more reflective of the national vote as a whole, which means it's probably a good night for Biden. Which means that Trump probably screwed in that scenario.
Yeah.
So I'd say probably, you know, it could just be he wins the blue wall back, and that was enough. You know, 4 years ago when everyone was freaking out over Hillary losing Florida, I'm like, well, whatever. She's still going to win the blue wall, and then it's over. It's GG. But then, you know, Wisconsin was like, oh, well, that's it then, I guess.
Yeah.
So he could win in Wisconsin, or he could win Arizona, or he could win both. You know. Or he could even win Florida. The one I'm pretty sure that Trump's probably going to win the swing states is North Carolina. It'll be close, but I think if I'm flipping an unfair coin, it would be biased towards Trump in that case.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm expecting if Biden does well to either get, you know, 278 or, you know, 279... electoral votes, you know, if it's close.
So
winning Michigan, Pennsylvania, plus Wisconsin or Arizona. If it's a big night, I think you could win all five.
Wow.
Maybe if it's a stupid, you know, really good North Carolina, but even I think that's probably a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. So in all of your predictions, you're saying Biden.
Yeah, because mathematically it's harder for Trump to win. He has to keep a lot of what he won 4 years ago in order to win. So like I said, if we're going in order of likelihood, he'd probably win North Carolina. After that, I'd probably give him Florida. That puts him at 248. Now he has to win, two more states. or maybe it's three. Yeah, he'd have to either win both Michigan and Pennsylvania, or he'd have to win three states, which is kind of a tall order. So let's give him Arizona, because that's gone Republican for years, and let's give him Wisconsin, because polling-wise, that's the closest one. Okay, well, that only puts him at 269. Although, hey, let's just give him the second district in Nebraska. Okay, so that puts him at 270. So that's one realistic winning scenario. If Biden only wins Michigan and Pennsylvania, and then Trump wins all the other ones, then yeah.
Well, that's close.
Narrow win.
Yeah.
Although, if the second district, which went Republican, or like it went... Maine and Nebraska are one of only two states that split their electoral votes based on congressional district. And Maine split its electoral vote for the first time 4 years ago when Trump won the second district.
Wow.
Most analysts have that leaning Republican. But let's say Biden just wins all of Maine. Well, then you end up in a 269-269 tie.
Oh.
In which case, the House of Representatives picks the president.
Whoa, wait.
Which is a bit wonky, because every state only gets one vote. And so because Republicans have majorities in more states than Democrats, the Republicans would basically just pick Trump.
Yeah.
So a 269-269 draw would be bad.
Very bad. Biden. Scary.
So, but yeah, that's only when you consider the congressional district shenanigans that you really get into 269-269 scenarios.
So what you're saying is, ultimately, it looks good, but we're not out of the woods yet. It looks good, but
it's not guaranteed by any stretch.
I see what you're saying. Well, that was a very interesting conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your thoughts. I'm guessing that ultimately this means that, you know, it's just going to be a very interesting election period, or like period leading up to the election. And it sounds like you're very invested in what happens, or right?
Well, yeah, I kind of don't want things to get worse than they already have.
Yeah.
But keep in mind, you know, I'm not like a partisan Democrat by any stretch. I voted in the Republican primary 4 years ago. I voted for Marco Rubio. And I was just very dismayed at Trump winning. And I even considered voting third party 4 years ago. But just the sheer thought of letting Trump become president, because I had such a stick up my ass that I couldn't bother to suck it up and vote for Clinton. Well, I'm like, okay, I won't do that. So I voted for her begrudgingly. Right. But now I am 2 out of 2 times I voted for the loser in the presidential election. 2012, I voted for Romney. So if anything, maybe I'll jinx it again if I vote for Biden. So maybe I should vote for Trump?
No! Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's been a crazy year, but do you feel like you're, because I know the last election you were not very, like, excited.
No, I mean, I didn't feel like I had a candidate for me 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I was just kind of voting because I had to stop Trump, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I thought at the very least, Clinton would kind of be a lame duck for 4 years because it'd be a Republican Congress, so she wouldn't really do anything. Like, okay, well, whatever. Doesn't rock the boat, that's good enough.
But is this election one where you feel pretty, like, excited?
Biden has his issues, but, you know, he's experienced. He was in a competent administration for 8 years. He doesn't have a ton of... I mean, he does have some skeletons. You know, he says weird shit sometimes. and he rambles on. And yeah, he's had a lifelong stutter. But like, and he gaffes all the time. But when Biden gaffes, it's like cute and adorable. When Trump gaffes, it's like, oh God. Like,
is he about to start World War III? Is he going to
start another war? Like,
yeah, for real. Oh my God. Also, his wife is kick-ass. I fucking love Dr. Biden. She is incredible. I also, like, side note, used to work with her. I used to teach with her. I was her teacher's assistant, and she was super sweet. And wrote me a very sweet email when I left saying that she would miss me. And apparently would reference me, like, because she worked with a couple of my other coworkers. And she's like, oh, well, you know, Alana always says that blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, my God, she's so cute. But she's also, like, a kick-ass lady. I thought it was so cool how she, you know, kept her job, kept teaching, kept doing what she loved, even while her husband was the vice president. I thought that was really tight. But yeah, it'll be very interesting, very scary, potentially, but I feel like we're in the right direction, right, Patrick? Like, ultimately, are you hopeful, even with some slight hesitation?
Well, I'm not hopeful for the crisis because, well, I mean, not hopeful, at least on the federal level. I think the state governors are doing great jobs, and the federal government just has no idea what it's doing at all under Trump's leadership. But I am hopeful that we will manage to get through it and that we will elect Biden and we will get a return to a government that does not have, that is not staffed with people that lie to us on a daily basis. Or at least doesn't lie to us about things that aren't, you know, national security.
It's so interesting how the most, like, basic needs,
you know, I can, like, understand lying for state secrets. I don't understand lying for basic health or common facts that people could just check on their own independently.
Right.
You know, we don't need somebody who's drawing Sharpies on maps because he wants to cover his ass because he accidentally said the wrong state 2 days earlier when he was talking about a warning for a hurricane.
Oh my God, yeah, I almost forgot about that. That happened, like, this year. That
happened last year.
Oh, it happened last year? Oh, okay.
Maybe it was a year before, I don't know.
Well, because there was that crazy tornado that went through Tennessee, like, right before coronavirus really got bad, I thought, too. Anyway, Trump is terrible with any kind of disaster. It's not just this one. It's pretty much everyone that's ever happened. So there's that. But I'm hopeful, even with hesitation. I am hopeful, and I'm glad things are potentially looking in the right direction, but only time will tell. And thanks again for tuning in, you guys. This is Politics with Patrick, and signing out. That's the end of our show. This is your host, Alana Rippey. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at huaf.productions. We post every other week, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And until next time, the best ship to sail on is friendship.